Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora, welcome to Country Life. I'm Duncan Smith.
And g'day, I'm Justin Gregory. It's great to have your company. Today, two young fruit growers are climbing the ladder at an orchard near Motueka.
We're travelling back in time to a remote bluff station in Marlborough for a high country muster.
And later we're taking you from the wool shed to a well-made bed, meeting a farming family spinning their dreams into reality via the homeware business.
But first, let's take a look at news from the primary sector this week. More government support will be heading the way of farmers and growers in the Marlborough, Tasman and Nelson districts, where an intense dry spell has been labelled a medium-scale adverse event. The aid, including tax support, comes on top of extra funding for the local Rural Support Trust. The dry is being felt further south too. The dam at Lake Opuha, near Fairlie, has only a few days' worth of water left. It supplies water to 16,000 hectares of farmland and generates electricity for the national grid. Sheep farmer David Williams uses the irrigation scheme and says the lake is looking pretty barren.
Well, yeah, the last 3 weeks it's really started to bite with us. Up until then we were going along quite nicely.
Have you had any decent rain?
About enough to wet the concrete last night. But we've had no significant rain since probably the middle of January, so we've had a month with basically nothing.
Animal genetics company LIC has released a new breeding value to reduce facial eczema in dairy herds. Facial eczema is caused by a fungal toxin in pasture and can cause liver damage and lead to lower production. It's expected to become more of a problem in the future as the climate warms up. LIC's Richard Spellman says it's a big development, but it's not a quick fix, as it will take 10 to 15 years to breed the more tolerant trait into herds.
It's a very long process. I mean, that's one of the key things here is that genetics is a long-term game. But if they use this product over a number of years, the tolerance of their animals to facial eczema will certainly improve. But in the meantime, you know, the practices that they undertake on farm, whether it's be through zinc dosing, etc., they absolutely should still continue with that.
Some other news which caught our eye this week was the use of artificial intelligence to better understand bees. Dr. Marcia McCauley of AUT has won a prestigious Fulbright scholarship to trial integrating AI into beekeeping, analysing and predicting stress levels to improve bee health.
Bees use buzzing as a form of communication, and changes in buzzing patterns, so might indicate a stress or disturbances within the hive. Analyzing and interpreting these sounds, they're really helping us to understand the well-being. So there is a correlation between the stress level and well-being and how they can actually prevent some of those that to be, you know, spread through the hive. So hopefully that knowledge and information can help beekeepers to take care of the well-being of the bees within a hive.
Some market news now, and the outlook for sheep meat is worsening, with farmers' profits expected to halve this season due to lower lamb and mutton prices. Demand from China still hasn't picked up, and Australia's been flooding the market. Beef and Lamb New Zealand's mid-season update has worsened since forecasts in October, and farm profits are expected to be down on average 54% on last season. It's reporting more farmers are switching from sheep to beef cattle as returns for beef are much higher, driven by strong demand from the United States.
New Zealand avocado growers are despondent as they start to close in on one of the worst years ever. Katikati grower Hugh Moore says last year's Cyclone Gabrielle battered the crop, so reject rates were high and yields were down. Export tray numbers have halved this year to about 1.3 million trays, and per tray returns are dismal.
And demand and prices for hops are down globally because people aren't drinking as much beer as they have done in the past. Hops New Zealand General Manager Blair Stewart says 85% of the crop is exported, mainly to the US. But since the pandemic closed many pubs, beer consumption hasn't picked back up. He says the craft beer boom helped prop sales up a little, but it's not enough. Blair Stewart says some growers may end up leaving the industry as a result of the downturn.
Probably most importantly, the quality is looking fantastic. I've heard some great stories about the aromas out there, so could be a bit of a vintage year for us. Everyone has a view on different weather patterns due to your hops, but overall, probably the hot, dry summer tends or looks to have really helped sharpen up those aromas.
Blair Stewart says it's a real shame because the harvest has just begun in Tasman and yields are looking really good.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Now we're heading to Rewaka in the Tasman district with Cosmo Kentish Barnes. He's with Jordan Porpata and Kahu Birdling at Thomas Brothers Orchard. Both were finalists in last year's Nelson Young Grower of the Year competition. They've got promising futures in the hort industry.
Jordan, how big is this orchard and what do you grow here?
We'd have about 150 hectares all up of cherries, apples and kiwi fruit. We have got at least 75 hectares of apples, if not more. And I'm not too sure about the kiwi fruit side of things, but it is a very big operation.
What's your role here?
I supervise out here and there's a variety of duties on a daily basis. But I generally make sure everyone's on track with what they've been told to do.
So do you have a team?
Yes, I definitely have a team. I've got a team of probably about, well, in harvest I'll have a team of about 20 Vanuatuan boys and they will be picking away on ladders.
Yes.
They're very good workers, so it makes my job a lot easier.
Are they a part of the RSE
yes.
scheme?
Yeah, a part of the RSE scheme. We'll have two lots of boys come in, one just before the apple harvest to help us thin all the apples off and take that workload down a little bit, and then we'll have a second load come in just before kiwi fruit harvest and they will help us pick all the kiwi fruit.
And Kahu, what do you do here?
Hi, I'm Kahu. I am a supervisor in the kiwi fruit on the off season, so I'm not harvest, I'll be pruning and thinning and etc. in the kiwi fruit, and then in the pack house time when it's harvest time I'm supervising in the apple pack house.
What is happening at the moment?
At the moment we're out thinning gold kiwi fruit and we're taking all the smalls off and cosmetic thinning. So we're taking all the ugly fruit off basically and keeping the pristine ones.
What's your journey? How did you first get into this industry?
My mum's ex-partner, he was working on the orchard at the time and he got me signed up in there and I started thinning when I was 16. Yeah.
And you've never looked back?
Pretty much, yeah.
So you're kind of working your way up?
Yeah, slowly trying to work my way up and get some more paper behind me and yeah.
Do you do what, leadership courses and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we do a lot of courses. We recently did a first aid course again, which was really cool. And we've got another leadership course coming up this Friday, actually.
What sort of things do you cover in those leadership courses?
Just how to manage my job better and how to manage people better. It's just basically working on yourself to make the crew work better. Yeah.
And tell me about the Thomas Brothers, because this orchard has been going for a while, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Yeah. Now they're awesome. They're so cool. Very welcoming and non-judgmental. And yeah, they, as soon as they seen me and seen that I was keen, they got me into higher level jobs and just constantly pushed me further and pushed me into places that I didn't think I'd be capable of doing, especially with the young grower, with public speaking and things like that. I didn't think I'd be able to do that. And from doing that, it's opened up so much different doors that I didn't think was possible.
Jordan, in terms of supervising, what are the most challenging parts about working in a big orchard like this?
I would have to say seeing my workers upset is probably the hardest thing, to be fair. I don't like people coming to work and not feeling like they can perform. It's good to have a good relationship with people and know what's going on. I think that's the hardest part, yeah.
Yeah, how about you, Kahu?
I think the hardest part is for me is in the pack house when there's a lot of stresses going on. Everyone's got a lot happening at once, but you want to be able to help people out that could be not at the in the best headspace, and it's really hard to do that because everyone is trying to make this work and make it is it's yeah. full on. It can be really full on, so it's just trying to juggle that and make sure that everyone's all good.
I guess doing those leadership courses helps you to manage those difficult situations.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. I took a lot away from last year's management course, so that definitely helped me a lot.
And how many people roughly work for Thomas Brothers?
I wouldn't have a clue. I know that there's a lot.
I have to say we probably employ around about 70 REC workers
yeah.
a year.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And then we'd have foreigners come in from Argentina and France and Malaysia.
Backpackers.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Do they just turn up and ask if there's any work?
Pretty much.
Yeah, yeah. And throughout like the thinning seasons, pruning seasons, we've got a big disease problem in apples at the moment, which is canker, so we've been trying to cut down on that. And so we've got quite a few employees hammering down on that at the moment.
For people who aren't familiar with that disease, what is canker and how do you deal with it?
It's a European strain and it's been introduced to New Zealand for quite some time now, but it's a pathogen that can lie in the ground for many years, but it can travel the spores for up to 50 kilometres in the right atmosphere, and it can wilt and affect your fruit, cause rots in fruit, eye rot, black spot. It's basically just a cancer for trees.
How do you deal with it?
We have to cut back to clean flesh. So the canker will be quite dark and black, and it will appear as though it's wilting and the tree's not healthy. So you cut that back to clean flesh, and we put a prune seal on it. And it just seals the wound, and it's also got a bacterial property in it that will take away that fungus.
So you have to go through all the orchards and do this?
Yes, so we've got a crew of about 20 people that go through, cut off branches, and then we've got a crew of about 4 that will go behind afterwards and grind out any lesions in the trunk, as you can't really cut them out. The ones in the trunk are the biggest, and the ones up the top, as when it rains, it just seeps down through the tree and affects the rest of it. I mean, if we didn't have our biosecurity team working full time, well then a lot of our orchards wouldn't be here.
And on that topic, at the Hort Awards, you won the Biosecurity Award.
I did. I won Biosecurity, and that was very, I guess, enlightening, because that was one thing that I didn't think I would get very far in. So that was awesome to hear my name called out.
Did you win a prize?
Yes, and Steve, my boss, actually awarded it to me. But I've still got to use it. I've got a canyoning experience at the Abel Tasman, so that will be cool.
Wow.
Definitely have to use that sometime soon.
Yeah. Kahu, what do you do when you're not working here at the orchard?
Oh gosh, I do pole classes and silk classes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and that's heaps of fun. That's awesome. And I stay at a caravan up in the valley next to the river. It's so beautiful. It's surrounded by just gorgeous scenic views and walks, and yeah, we're pretty lucky to live around here.
And Jordan, how about you?
I like getting out and doing a little bit of camping and fishing. It's always been a big passion. Just definitely like being outdoors, and yeah.
Yeah. We are standing in an apple orchard now behind one of the pack houses. Tell me about these apples here. What variety are they?
We've got Koru through here. They're probably still another couple of years off full production, but they're looking good and quite healthy. It's got a good crop load on it at the moment. So
yes. Where does all the fruit go to that's grown here?
All of it goes through the pack house, and then it'll get deciphered whether it's grade 1, which is export quality, grade 2, or local market.
The fruit that's grown here is eaten by people all over the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's crazy to see the people from those countries coming here to help us produce the fruit that they eat.
Yeah.
So that's quite cool.
Yeah.
Behind us, a large truck has arrived at the pack house. What's that picking up or dropping off?
It looks like to me it's dropping off a load of gravel.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2 tipper trailers. Lots of pathways getting redone because of wheel ruts and from the season before. When we pick, it's generally quite muddy, and a lot of tractors going through the rows makes it pretty messy, so lots of cleanup.
Has any harvesting started yet?
Not yet.
No, we will have a new variety that we will be harvesting very shortly, within the next couple of weeks.
It's called the Redhead, eh?
Yeah, RV14.
Yeah.
So an early apple variety.
Yeah, it's a newer early apple variety, and we've, by the sounds of it, got one of the biggest plantations in the southern hemisphere of the RV14. Very new variety. So it'll be very interesting to have that picked. There's not very much there. It's one of the first years that it's in production.
And Kahu, are there any new kiwi fruit varieties this year?
Yeah, there is. We've just planted out some red kiwi fruit this year. And so that's very exciting. We've ripped out a whole block and replanted. And it's looking really beautiful in there at the moment.
All the structures and stuff going up for it. It's looking quite complete now.
It is. Yeah. It's looking wicked.
Red kiwi fruit.
Red kiwi fruit.
Yeah, I feel as though red may have been an older strain of kiwi fruit that's come back around as well.
Oh.
I feel.
They're quite small and they're crossed with raspberries. Berries, I think, or something like that.
Yeah. Nice red flesh.
Yeah. How delicious.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to young people listening to this who are thinking of entering the horticultural industry?
Oh, just go for it. There's so many different jobs that are available. You'll be surprised. It's not just picking and packing. Just show your people that you're keen on it and you'll be surprised at how far you can go.
Yes, lots of opportunities, whether you're into machinery or just actually growing a good crop or the science behind the biology, you could go anywhere in the industry and it's just really eye-opening to see marketing, anything like that, you know.
What's the first step young people should take?
Just go in and see your local orchardist or whoever you think you would like to go and work for. Family businesses are very welcoming and they're very non-judgmental. You could have a pretty rough past and they'd still welcome you like anybody else, so don't be afraid, jump into it.
That was Jordan Pulpata. Cosmo was also chatting with Kahu Birdling at Thomas Brothers Orchard in Rewaka.
Now, we're turning back the clock to late summer in 1956 to give you a taste of a high country sheep muster before the advent of quad bikes and cell phones. We're on remote Bluff Station, a 22,000-plus hectare property in Marlborough. In the heat of February, every single sheep had to walk 90 kilometres to the woolshed for shearing. Bruce Petrie from the New Zealand Wool Board is the narrator of this story. He accompanied the muster that year when 4,000 ewes were moved down from the backcountry to Kekaringu on the coast by 7 shepherds, a pack train and 40 dogs.
The radio telephone's been a great boon to the backcountry. Its invisible fingers have probed into the heart of the mountain chain and linked back station and front station for twice daily conferences, when, a few years ago, the quickest way to get a message between the Bluff and Kekerang was to send a man on a 2-day horse ride. As the sheep were being mustered in the backcountry, down at the home station at Kekerang, Jim Chafee, the station owner, sat in his office in front of the big radio telephone transmitter calling the Bluff homestead.
Kekerang calling Bluff. Kekerang calling Bluff. Over.
Hello, Kekerang. Yes, you're coming in all right here. Beautiful morning. No clouds.
Long and low slung, the Bluff station homestead among its tall poplars looks like something out of an old print. It's got the appearance of great age and a certain workmanlike dignity about it. It's built of clay and tussock, a mixture known as cob. It clings close to the earth from which it was made, and its high, sharply sloping roof shows that the homestead was built to withstand heavy snows. It's occupied today by Mr. and Mrs. Roberts, the parents of the head shepherd, who cook and care for the backcountry lads. Les Roberts, the head shepherd, and his wife Edna live in another cob house, a little more modern, close by. And Edna, who 3 years ago was a town girl, and who's now tractor driver, radio telephone operator, and general chatelaine of the Bluff, told us how they managed their domestic affairs at the loneliest sheep station in New Zealand.
We live in cob buildings. One must be well over 100 year old, and the other comparatively recent for that, for these times, but it's an interesting life. The homesteads are surrounded by trees, tall poplars, towering about 140 feet, You drop down then to the riverbank, and we have swimming. We have a tennis court built now, and, well, we just make our own fun as we go along. We do our own, we have to shift for ourselves everywhere. For a start, we make our own bread, all our cooking, of course, cakes, buns, anything like that. We live principally on mutton. For a change, of course, we go out on the hills, shoot pigs, deer, and occasional rabbits.
Before dawn next morning, the sheep would begin their long walk, moving in the cool hours of the day only, to the front country. Somewhere out on the run, the shepherds were holding them and preparing for the 6 days' drive over river, gorge, limestone face and high tussock land, which would end within sound of the Pacific breakers at Kekerang, within sight almost of Wellington City. How much wool was being walked out on this leisurely but obviously important occasion? The average flock of sheep in New Zealand's about 1,200. We'd be moving with a mob of 4,000 and only the ewe flock at that. What, in terms of bales of wool, would the harvest be?
These sheep that are being driven out tomorrow will yield approximately 170 odd bales of wool. We reckon on about 30 bales of wool to the 1,000 sheep. We run, we shear roughly about 13,000, which gives us about 390-400 bales of wool.
Moving off with the pack train, we caught up with the shepherds at the first sheep camp, a corrugated iron shed beside the Clarence River. A mile or so away, the mob was held in a fenced paddock, about the only time you'll see a fence in the high country. 4,000 sheep would look a pretty large mob if it went along a city street. Here, on the slopes of a 10,000-foot mountain, it's no more significant than a sprinkling of salt on a wall-to-wall carpet. The horses graze alongside the sheep camp, and 40 dogs are tethered to the fence. Saddlery and gear are piled outside the hut, and there's the smell of roasting mutton and billy tea. We meet Les, Rom, Trevor, Jack, Ben and Bob, the shepherds, and the accents on youth. You realize that with different hats and more colorful shirts, you have met the authentic Wild West cowboy type, the man whose conversation concerns only dogs and horses, and for whom the world outside the high country doesn't exist except as a place to spend money in and to get out of in a hurry. Bob Middlemiss, a born high countryman, gave us an idea of what was going to happen on the sheep drive.
We have got to keep our sheep at a steady pace all the way on account of the stiff climbs, straight uphill and straight down the other sides of them. If we didn't, we would only land at our destination with half our flock. And the way we keep them going, we've got two men, one on each side, about 50 yards back from the lead. Then there's another man comes in on the bottom side, and then we have one or two men bringing up the tail. And that is the easiest way to keep a large mob on a steady pace all the way through. After we land in with the sheep to the front, they are shorn. Then they're dipped straight off the shears. Then they've got, on top of that, they've got the 56-mile trip back to the backcountry again. And it is the only way that we have of getting our sheep and our wool out of the back country.
From now on, we had only two ways of getting anywhere, on horse or on foot. And on the steep faces, it was always on foot. We moved at dawn through a rough country where there wasn't any foreground prettiness, a country of splendid vistas and magnificent distant scenery. Our pastoral symphony was fully orchestrated. Barking dogs, the high-pitched, queerly oriental call of the shepherds strung out along the flanks of the mob. Speaking waters, The occasional explosion is a piece of limestone loosened by the noise of our passing, hurtled 1,000 feet down the slopes, and the creak and jingle of saddlery. The horse was the most important unit in our universe. As Jim Chafee said,
high country shepherding of today, that is, can't be carried on today without, of course, the use of horses and dogs. The horses, we breed our own and supply the shepherds with two each, except that the odd shepherd has his own horse. And we run, we have to run still a pack team to pack our shepherds through from the front to the back and the back to the front. And there might be approximately 50-odd horses on the place.
What gear does the shepherd need for a trip like this? We travelled as a self-sufficient unit supplying our own needs, slaughtering our meat as we went. And every 2 days, the knives came out to reduce the flock to provide our meals and the dogs' meals too. Bob Middlemas, who killed 3 sheep and skinned them while we were waiting for the mob to pour into the holding paddock at the Mead Hut, went into detail.
On this trip through here, each shepherd has got his own private bedroll with him, and that consists of a canvas sleeping bag, and then he has got 2 or 3 blankets, which he folds inside. And then he has got 1 or sometimes 2 sets of clothing. It depends on how long he is on the trip through. And they roll into quite a nice little roll so as you can fit 2 each side of a pack horse. And on our hacks, we carry our oilskins, oilskin leggings, tucker bag, our little billy, a little bit of tea and sugar, and our midday meal. And all our dog chains, our shears, and I always carry a pair of pliers for any breakages in fences or anything like that. They come in very, very handy at times, especially around holding paddocks, or if you've got to take a horse over a fence or anything.
The most solitary figure on the sheep drive, the maid of all work, the universal provider, cook and bagman, is the packman. With his team of pack horses, he keeps to the pack track, which is often barely visible, sometimes washed away, and he moves from sheep camp to sheep camp, leaving after the mob has moved off with the dawn and arriving at the next camp sometimes 2 hours before the leaders of the mob appear over the skyline. Jack McDonald was our packy on the bluff trip, an old hand at the game and a skillful cook. Although we used horses for packing, Jack still had a soft spot for mules, which used to do the carrying work.
The one big advantage with mules, I found, was that they are cheaper to run because you do not have to shoe them, and they will live on less feed. And also, they are, from the packman's point of view, they are far better to load because they are not so high and you do not have to lift the heavy packs up so high. Horses, I like them very much. I really like horses better than mules, but the horses, I found them, if there's any feed about, they will stop and graze and you've got to keep on hunting them along. Whereas with the old mule, he will keep on going straight ahead from one camp to the other. And if the track is bad, he will carry on. It'd take a lot to stop a mule, because if the track was there before, he always thinks it should be still there.
Taking our larder from camp to camp was a fairly complicated business compared with, say, having lunch at a 5-star hotel. All our food was carried in tucker boxes slung along across the horses, and if the pack train broke into a canter, which it sometimes unaccountably did, the hillsides rang to the mad jangling of knives and forks, mugs and tin plates, all bouncing about in the boxes.
The tucker boxes contain quite a mixed
collection of foods, chiefly amongst them being bread, jam, cheese, sugar, tea, rice, butter, dried apples, and ready mixed plum puddings. Just got to mix them up in the basin and put them on to boil. Also, we take onions, plenty of potatoes. On the bluff trip, actually on the main muster, 80 pound of potatoes are taken, and that just does the trip if we have a straight run. The food is cooked in a big pot called a camp oven, which is an iron pot with three legs and a lid on top which holds the steam in. You put the meat into this and hang it on the fire and keep a nice even heat, and it will cook meat just as good as anybody can in an electric oven or any other coal fire. In fact, a lot of people think it is a lot better. It's just a matter of taste. The meat on the journey is killed as we go along, just as we require it. Owing to the hot weather, it does not keep long, and if it's very hot, a sheep will only keep 2 days on the journey on account of not getting time to set properly. This meat, as we have no refrigerators, is just carried in a chaff bag on the side of the horse. And time we get to a camp, doesn't altogether look like meat, but still she eats all right, and the boys are hungry and enjoy it.
At night, all cats are grey, and to hungry men, meat is meat, whether it's been kept in a chaff sack or in a deep freeze. Anyway, by the time we'd reached the old Coverham homestead, now a sheep camp, and more than 100 years old, the butter and jam was getting a bit shop-soiled, and the bread was grey with fatigue. The sight of a bulldozed road, a prospect which pleased our packy, aroused guilty feelings that one's personal hygiene wasn't all that it might have been, and that perhaps one should think about doing one's hair or changing one's shirt. But really, it seemed to be too much bother. After all, we'd escaped from the tyranny of the bathroom for 5 days, and we weren't likely to meet anybody who was fastidious about washing. We were taking on a pastel shade, and doing all those things which our parents had spent a great deal of time warning us about, such as eating with our knives, not washing before breakfast, sleeping in our clothes, using other people's spoons, licking our plates, using bad language. In fact, pretty well all the things listed in the calendar of domestic misbehaviour.
That was a story about the muster in 1956 on Marlborough's Bluff Station. It was narrated by Bruce Petrie and recorded using one of the New Zealand Broadcasting Service's new portable tape recorders. It's an early example of a radio documentary using actuality recorded in the field. Our thanks to Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision, where you can find the full 58-minute documentary.
Hi, this is Graham.
And I'm Gillian.
We're from Miners Camp in Endeavour Inlet, and you're listening to Country Life.
RNZ National.
To Central Hawke's Bay now, where a farming family is spreading the good word about New Zealand wool. Here's producer Maggie Tweedy.
It's a warm summer's afternoon, and the aircon is on high as I drive 30 minutes south of the Waipukuro township up Ugly Hill Road to meet Kate and Jeremy Culwick and their kids Oscar and Bess. The couple were vets in another life, practising in Dannyburg before moving to Jeremy's family sheep and beef farm, Tapahia.
When I was practising in Dannyburg, I met my wife Kate at a veterinary conference in Palmerston North. She'd recently graduated, and a couple of years later we were married, and indicated to Kate when we met it had always been in my heart that I was keen to come back to the family farm here. So we moved back here in the end of 2011. It's looking pretty green for this time of the year, although it's starting to brown off a little bit. We've had good rain through December and a bit into January, so
there's an incredible amount of feed on these hills.
Yeah, that's right. Actually the last 3 years have been very wet sort of summers, and so this is quite incredible really to have had three seasons where we've had a lot of feed going through the summer, and that's brought its own set of challenges, a lot more animal health issues when it is wet and warm, parasites, fly strike and all sorts. But the preceding 8 years or so, we've been back, been very dry most of the summers, so it's good healthy weather, the dry weather.
It can get kind of spory out there, can't it?
Yeah, we are prone to getting facial eczema in this area, in the valley below us here, where we have quite a lot of our stock grazing. It's high risk, so we've brought in facial eczema tolerant genetics in the last 5 years into our sheep flock, and that's certainly helping. We have Angus cattle and they don't seem to be too affected by facial eczema, which is good.
7 years ago, Kate teamed up with her sister to start an online homeware business designed to fit in with family life, and now using wool from the farm. She gets stuck into farming too. After the stock manager left, she dusted off her shepherding skills and trained up another dog to help out.
So that's Baz saying hello to you down there. Baz is in training. He's my handy dog. There he is. And I have been a shepherd before in a previous life. And as a vet, I used to work on farms. And so, yeah, it was lovely to come back into that because I really do miss being outside, to be honest. And I really miss the physical work. And I do love farming as well. So it was a terrific couple of months of us working together, and we're still married and still talking. And Baz is coming along really nicely. And, yeah. It's wonderful. I miss it. We've got the most incredible stock manager now who's joined the team, and we're really lucky and very grateful. But now I have to go back to the computer. I've got no excuse.
Hi.
Hey, just quickly catching up regarding those emails.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, I think they're looking pretty good. Just need to, you know, make a few tweaks.
While Kate chats to her sister, Prue Watson, Jeremy and I duck up to a high point overlooking Tapahia and the neighbouring Mangorapa station.
And I can see a group of black cattle there on the hill line. Are those your Angus cattle?
Yeah, that's a small group of cows, and stud cows and their calves, Maggie, yeah.
They're nice up there on the hill country, which is how they like it.
Yep, absolutely. They're great machines on the hill country and cleaning up after the ewes and producing a good calf while they're doing that as well. We both enjoy the cattle, Angus cattle breeding, and it's certainly a shared passion.
And that area of genetics is really interesting because you never feel like you've kind of made it, and that kind of sets the goalpost a little bit further along, doesn't it? Do you feel that challenge is really stimulating for you intellectually as well?
Yes, absolutely. We've been using genomics here in the last 12 months or so, which is DNA sampling the cattle, and the Angus breed is heavily genomically tested, mainly due to large numbers in the world. So they can identify certain traits and those animals which are likely to breed better for those particular traits. So it does speed up your level of genetic progress, so I'm loving that side of it, into the detail of that, and whilst, you know, maintaining a good animal phenotypically as well.
Jeremy's parents bought Tapahia nearly 50 years ago. Kate and Jeremy say they were lucky to work for them for 7 years. 5 years ago, they were given the opportunity to run the farm, and that's opened doors to new ventures.
We've actually ended up purchasing Kate's family Angus stud off her parents who have retired into Gisborne. That was Waimata Angus up the Waimata Valley.
How beautiful and really exciting opportunity for you. When did you take that over?
So we purchased some Angus females 18 months ago. We bought some down. So, it was early days for us, but we were absolutely thriving on that opportunity and loving it.
The farm has paddocks full of hunter, a type of fast-growing leafy turnip, and lots of beautiful, well-established trees.
Yeah, that's something Kate and I have carried on as well. The other interesting thing too, which is you can just see part of from where we're standing, is a QE2 area that we've...
have you got a covenant?
Had covenanted in the last 6 months. That's just happened. It was fenced last autumn, just before Gabrielle struck. It's deer fenced, 12.5 hectares. 6 hectares of it is an existing mature native bush, and then the other 4 or 5 hectares we're planting with assistance from the local Porongahoe catchment group. It's got a nice freshwater stream with a nice waterfall and some cooler in the stream, so yeah, it's nice to fence that off and let the bird life establish.
It's time to head inside for Smoko. Kate and her daughter Bess have whipped up a fresh batch of banana muffins with yellow icing. Her son Oscar's here too.
I'm going to go down on my motorbike with a worker and I'm going to help.
Cool. And how the school holidays been for you?
Fun, really good. Played with my sister lots and done lots of Lego.
Yeah. And what's it like living here?
Really cool and fun, really lucky.
It's nice because you get to run around and you don't have to stay in the backyard of a town if you're in a town.
Hmm.
And if you're bored, you can just go out on the farm and watch all the sheep and that. Or you could explore. I like exploring sometimes.
So you don't get bored very often?
No.
And you go to Flemington School, which is just down the road. How long does it take you to get to school? Is there a school bus?
Yes, it's about 10 minutes, I'm pretty sure.
While Jeremy and Oscar head off to dip some sheep, Kate explains how she started up her homeware business, Foxtrot. After hanging up her vet instruments and becoming a mother, she and her sister decided to join forces. Prue was wanting a change of pace from her corporate city job, and Kate had just sold her small business making lampshades. They wanted to switch things up, and that's when they stumbled across the idea of selling linen.
The powers that be suddenly were very kind to us. I'm not sure how it worked out. We didn't think, wow, this is going to be huge. Let's get onto this. We just,
It wasn't the ambition.
Not at all. I mean, it was we wanted to do well.
Yeah.
But it was going to support us, you know, it was going to prop us up. And we had no idea that this big wave of interest and was going to happen. We weren't clever enough to sort of look at products on the rise, if you like, or anything like that, that were coming into fashion. So,
but you knew that was what you liked.
We knew that was exactly what we liked. And I remember we were both at school that we used to wear linen shirts. Like, that was a thing. And linen skirts were a thing. So this is the 80s, I think.
Okay.
And I do remember it being big then in clothes. I do remember thinking that, wow, that was really lovely. Oh, and why is it not around anymore? What the heck? I mean, it's such a cool fabric. It looks
especially
beautiful
in hot places like the East Coast. We need breathable fabrics to wear in the heat of the day.
Absolutely. And I don't think, as a kid, you know, wearing it in the 80s, I mean, that was never a consideration. It was just, you know, it was probably a fashion. And as a kid, you're like, well, we'll follow the fashion. And it was, you know, but I still always had this little part of me thinking, you know, that was still cool. Why is that not around? Because linen is much better for the planet as far as growth and manufacturing.
With all this talk of fabrics, we head down the hallway and into Kate's home office. On the table sits a sewing machine, parcels ready for sending, and stacks of natural linen and woolen blankets.
So this is our ginger honey, and this is our natural, which is probably our top seller. We're just starting to make these at the moment. These are cushions. So, yes, and we're working with a local wool lady for that too, keeping it all natural. This is another one. It's sort of a whiter colour. All our wool is designed to complement our linen, so it's all mix and match. We've got about 28 different linen colours now. I think it's approximately 12. Yeah, different products for our wool, so you know, there's an awful lot of combinations in there, and it's all designed to mix and match. Just take what you like and make your own delicious ice cream out of it.
Wool felt like a natural step for the sisters who had fleeces on their doorstep, just begging to be made into bedding.
We literally have all our bales stacked up down in one of the sheds at the moment, and that will go to the wool scourers soon in Napier, and they do their thing by removing all the impurities and taking the linen out and making it clean for us. And then it gets shipped down to Wellington, which is where it gets processed into yarn. They've been doing that a long time, wool yarns in Wellington, and they really know their stuff, and they're terrific to deal with. And that's where also they dye our wool. So Prue and I will choose the colours. That's a process we go through for several weeks and months before the wool even arrives. So at the moment, I'm tasked with looking after that wool. We were already sending it to the UK and to America, but to formalise that more and really step it up, because we know it has a huge future. We really want to do our bit for New Zealand wool as well. I mean, it sounds like, we're obviously doing it for Foxtrot Home, but no, it's more about, it's equally as important for the awareness of wool, which is the most incredible super fibre. It really is. Incredibly safe, fire retardant, antibacterial, biodegradable, fully sustainable.
And it's not being used. So how do you feel about, you know, where New Zealand is in terms of how we are embracing wool? Obviously, we know we have a really long way to go in terms of adopting this beautiful fibre and making sure it's widely used in the home.
Yes.
There's lots of people who are passionate about using it as insulation, mm-hmm. as, you know, stuffers for couches. I even hear, like, there's a lipstick brand locally that's using lanolin.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, the carpets, you know, our carpet industry has taken such a massive hit for, you know, I mean, it was at the 80s, I think, or might have been as early as the 70s. When plastic carpets came about, and that's you know, still a concern, is, you know, the price point with plastic, and you know, it's all very well saying that this is better for you, but not everyone can afford it, and so we just got to be careful with our message. I think is, like, yes, absolutely, this is the way we should do it, but you can't expect everybody to be able to. And how we're gonna, you know, get wool, you know, back in again, and awareness that, you know, New Zealand farmers are not that need their help. You know, this wonder fibre is available and ready, and should be supported. And the more we talk about it, the more awareness. We're optimistic, cautiously optimistic, that something can be done about that.
Stuff.
So this is the main wool shed, and some of these bales behind us will be lamb's wool. Then this time next year we hope to have some blankets out of that, which is really exciting. And yeah, a lovely feeling knowing that sitting there is going to be minimally processed and all with the New Zealand, and then ending up as a product we can showcase to the world, as it were, I guess.
Sorry about the dog.
Oh no, you're good.
Bears! Charge!
There was a bit of rain here just before Christmas, wasn't there? Was it that hard getting all your sheep crutched and shorn before the summer season kicked in?
Yeah, there was. Early December, there was quite a bit of rain. So that's been a big challenge, Maggie, trying to get the work done. We're fussy as farmers. We want the rain to grow feed, but then we want it sunny as well so the stock do and we can get things done. So yeah, we're hard to please, us farmers.
And what was it like when Kate decided to start up Foxtrot with Prue? How many years ago was that? And what's that been like, taking on this new business as a couple? Was that something you were a little bit hesitant to do in the beginning?
No, I was thrilled. Initially, Foxtrot was about the linen, and they were looking for a new natural fibre to go along with that. And then lambs wool came onto their radar, and obviously we had several tons worth of lambs wool we were producing here every year.
From how many sheep?
From, so with about 3,500 lambs we shear a year. So the first year they took 7 or 8 bales, and then the next year they took the whole lot. So it's great. I mean, it's just such a thrill when the blanket comes back from being produced at the knitting mill to hold it in your hands and think that the wool came off the farm. That's a pretty cool feeling. It's been fantastic. I mean, Kate's incredibly entrepreneurial and has a huge amount of energy and enthusiasm. It's just been a really cool journey to watch them grow the business and be as successful as they have. It just I'm just so incredibly proud of her and both of them and how well they've done with it.
A year on from Cyclone Gabriel, Kate says she feels lucky they've had business success and really believes in the power of community. She says Foxtrot Home wants to continue using their platform to promote the work of Rural Women New Zealand and the charities I Am Hope and Meet the Need.
The rest is history so far. It's been hugely popular. We took it to the Wanaka show last year, and that was just, you know, incredible, the response to it. It's just, it's really quite special stuff, and we're really excited about its future.
Kate Culwick. You also heard from Jeremy Culwick and Prue Watson. And that piece was produced by Maggie Tweedy.
That's all from us this time around. You can head to our webpage for photos from the farm. Just go to rnz.co.nz/countrylife. Please send us your feedback. We always love to hear from you. You can email us on country@rnz.co.nz.
Bye now.
Ka kite. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.